Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us this morning. Also glad to welcome back to the program David Sinnell, President, CEO, Strategic Capital Bank and Trust. He's on the program every month. It's always a Friday. We talk about personal finance. The way that we do this is he starts out and has a few comments for you, usually on something related to the economy or financial planning. And then if you have questions on that or anything else, you can give us a call. So with that, we say welcome back. Glad to have you here.
Well, good morning, David. And of course, as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be here with you. Well, let's talk a little bit about taxes for a few moments. Every day we hear snippets of the proposed $1.6 trillion Bush tax reduction plan. And apparently the highlights of the plan include A, an actual reduction in the current five marginal income tax rates, B, the elimination of the marriage penalty, and C, an elimination of estate or those terrible death taxes. Well, at the same time, the Democrats are proposing a program which envisions an approximate, call it $800 billion, maybe $1 trillion income tax cut, but details of which are quite sketchy at the present time. Philosophically, however, Democrats oppose the elimination of estate taxes and argue that tax relief really should be targeted to the middle class and lower middle class rather than the upper middle class and very wealthy Americans. I think that part of the argument is substantially clear. Obviously, the tax story will unfold over the next several months, and no doubt in the final form, the new tax laws will add scores of pages. It will add scores of new regulations to an already bloated and incomprehensible tax code. For those of you who have seen the tax code booklet, it's literally thousands of pages, and I think that you need a microscope to actually read the fine print, let alone the regulations. However, in spite of that, certain dominant themes are indeed emerging and coalescing both from the Republicans and the Democratic rhetoric. First, regardless of the actual dollar amount of the cuts will likely be phased in over a number of years, somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 to 10 years. And mathematically, of course, this makes sense. After all, if our annual budget calls for receipt of somewhere between $1.5 and $2 trillion of revenue, it would obviously be far-fetched and economic suicide to provide the American taxpayer with an immediate $1 trillion plus tax cut. In such a case, we would then end up borrowing money back from ourselves, issuing lots of new U.S. Treasury instruments in order to fund our voracious appetite for government. Second, there seems to be far less talk about serious reduction of the capital gains tax rate just in the last week. Let's review the basic rules quickly. Now, assume, for example, you own a stock which you purchased for $100, and the stock is now worth $200, and you sell it. And, of course, you would then pocket the $200. Well, of course, the difference between the purchase price of $100 and the selling price of $200 is your capital gain. And in this example, you would realize a $100 capital gain. And assuming you held the stock for at least 1 year, you would pay a capital gains tax. And for most of us, that long-term capital gains tax rate is 20% of the gain, or in our example, 20% of $100, $20. Now, one of the impediments to capital formation, indeed, is the capital gains tax. In fact, we have the highest capital gains tax rate, really, in the free world. And as a result, it is persuasively argued that many entrepreneurs and firms locate in more tax-friendly countries in order to escape this capital gains tax. At this point in the great tax debate on Capitol Hill, it appears that the Bush administration is wavering on its commitment to seriously reducing the capital gains tax rate. Interestingly enough, under Reagan, when the capital gains tax rate was reduced from 28% to 20%, Americans sold capital assets at a record pace, reinvested these proceeds in America, and the net result was actually increased business activity and a net gain in tax collections. Isn't that interesting? People actually sold their capital assets. A lot of those capital assets were just bottled up in non-producing assets, sold them, paid tax, more money went to the government, and more of this money then got recirculated back into the economy and helped jumpstart the economy. Now, a third dominating theme that is now emerging is estate tax relief, but not the total elimination of estate taxes as the Bush administration originally was suggested. In fact, isn't it interesting that now some of our wealthiest Americans in this country, including just last night David Rockefeller, Warren Buffett, and Bill Gates' family, really Bill Gates' father, were interviewed on national television, and they are opposing the elimination of the estate tax. They argue that eliminating the estate tax would have a profound impact on charitable giving. Now, it's important to understand that any assets at death that are left to a bona fide charity escape both income tax and federal estate tax. So let's take an example of a typical wealthy American like, let's talk about Ed Kezar and his $10 million estate of stocks and bonds, which he might leave to someone else. This estate would pay estate tax at a marginal rate of 55%. In fact, the actual federal estate tax bill on a $10 million estate would indeed approximate $5 million. Once an estate is greater than $3 million, each dollar thereafter is taxed at a marginal rate of 55%, 55 cents on the dollar. And in other words, by leaving money to charity, the government will be subsidizing an estate to the tune as much as 55 cents on the dollar. Or another way of looking at it, would you like to leave a dollar to charity, or would you rather leave 55 cents of that dollar to the Internal Revenue Service, and 45 cents perhaps to your kids? That's the bottom line of the nature of the marginal tax impact on estate taxes. Once you leave more than $675,000 in the year 2001, the next dollar is marginally taxed at 37 cents. So in any event, the dominating theme emerging on Capitol Hill is to increase the amount of assets which will not be subject to estate tax rather than the elimination of estate taxes. For example, under current law, by the year 2006, if your estate is $1 million or less, no federal estate tax would be due at the death of an individual. And as I just mentioned, currently the dollar limit is $675,000. So if someone dies, leaves an estate of less than $675,000, maybe to your kids, that estate is not subject to federal estate tax. But if it's more than that, the next dollar starts being marginally taxed at 37 cents on the dollar, and it incrementally increases all the way up to 55%, depending upon the size of the estate. But lots of wealthy Americans are suggesting, no, we shouldn't get rid of this because this is going to have an impact on how much people are going to leave to charity. Now, the truth of the matter is that these very wealthy Americans have their own charitable foundations. So their estates are set up so that when they die, all of their money passes to their own charitable foundation and escapes estate tax. And then the charitable foundation, of course, is required to distribute so much of these dollars each year to any bona fide charity. Now, switching gears for just a moment, let's talk briefly about income taxes, because it's not very long until April 15th shows up and you got to pay unless you've been paying as you go. First of all, you actually have until April 16th to file your 2000 tax return. So you get an extra day because of the weekend. Second, in 2001, this year, Social Security taxes are paid on the first $80,400 of earnings. In other words, wage earners could pay as much as $4,985 in Social Security taxes. That's plucked right out of your paycheck. And of course, the employer pays a like amount. So in order to make certain that the Social Security system doesn't go broke, each year, the wage base on which Social Security or payroll taxes are based goes up, and now it's over $80,000. And now we're closing in on people paying $5,000 out of their paycheck in Social Security tax. Don't forget that you pay also 1.45% in Medicare tax. And that's on an unlimited wage base. So if someone makes $10,000, they're paying 1.45%. I guess that would be about what, $14.50? Whatever, to Social Security. Actually, that would be $145. Can't do my math very well this morning, so it's $145. If you make $1 million, you'd pay $14,500 in Medicare tax. Thirdly, the ceiling on employee contributions to a 401k plan. We've talked a lot about 401k plans. It's the same in 2001 as it was in 2000. 15% of pay, the maximum is $10,500 that you can contribute to a 401k plan. Finally, if you use your car for business, taxpayers may deduct, get a load of this, 34.5 cents a mile for all business miles driven in 2001 instead of deducting the actual automobile costs. Well, David, a little bit of income tax, a little bit of federal estate tax. I guess it's just a veritable tax salad of delights out there that are coming our way in 2001, and I'd certainly be happy to address these issues or any other financial issues that are on our audience's mind.
All right. And by the way, I talked with Ed Kieser just before coming to do the show, and he asked me just to remind everyone that he did not have a $10 million estate, and this was purely hypothetical.
Okay.
Just for the record.
Okay.
All right. We have several callers. Somebody on a cell phone here first in Bloomington, line number 4. Hello?
Hello.
Yes?
I was wondering if there would ever be a advantage whenever you're on the front end of a home mortgage to pay off the home mortgage as opposed to taking the tax deduction for the home mortgage interest.
Well, that's a very good question, and it depends, of course, one, on your marginal tax rate. So if you find yourself in a 28 or 31% marginal tax rate, let's just take 31%, and your mortgage is 7%, and you itemize, and the government is essentially subsidizing you 31% of that 7% interest rate, so your effective rate is a little bit below 5%. And a lot of people are now refinancing mortgages, and mortgage interest is available at about 7%. So if you are itemizing, the effective after-tax rate on that mortgage is probably in the 5% area. So the question becomes, could you take your money and invest it after-tax at more than 5%? Maybe yes, maybe no, depending upon what kind of savvy investor you turn out to be. Now, if you have a, if you are not itemizing on your mortgage and you're paying 7 or 8%, then obviously the faster that you pay that down, the better off you're going to be. The major issue, it seems to me, as a financial planner, and this is something that we see in our own financial planning and investment practice, and I think it's extremely important. It's something I preached for a long time. You want to make certain that when you retire, that you've got that mortgage paid off. You don't want to go into retirement still making a very substantial mortgage payment. And I think that's the real story here. If you can pay down more quickly, that's a good idea all of the time. But clearly, you don't want to go into retirement with a very substantial mortgage because it really can impact on your cash flow. Does that help you out?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you. This morning, here on Focus 580, our guest is David Sino. He's president and CEO of Strategic Capital Bank and Trust, and he is here on the program every month. Always on a Friday, we talk about personal finance, money management. You have questions about investment or anything else, I know Dave will do his best to give you an answer. And all you have to do is call us. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. Also, we have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call for you, use the number, toll-free number, 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Champaign, and it's line one.
Yes. I was calling about the college savings plans, and I was wondering, I have an inheritance that's just about paid for my three kids to go to college, but I was wondering, should I go ahead and buy the prepaid college tuition plan or go into the Bright Start deferred or Bright Start savings plan or just stick with mutual funds?
Let me give you a couple of responses to that. First of all, with respect to College Illinois, and you can visit their website, I think it's collegeillinois.com, www.collegeillinois.com. I'm very high on the prepaid college tuition because by their own admission, they're presuming tuition and fee increases based on over 8%. And I think it's very, very difficult to go out in the marketplace and earn a tax-deferred 8 to 8.5%. That's really what the cost of college in terms of tuition and fees in Illinois has been increasing by the state's own admission over the last good number of years. Very tough to out-earn that. In addition, if you are in the prepaid college program, when those dollars are utilized by your student, then the earnings on those dollars are taxed at the student's marginal tax rate, which is very likely to be a lower rate than the parent's rate. So the student might find themselves in a 15% rate or maybe no rate at all, depending upon their situation. So a great deal of that money that is growing and earning for you at this 8 to 8.5% rate may well be tax sheltered forever. Very, very tough to beat that. Now, remember, this just covers tuition and fees. It doesn't cover books. It doesn't cover transportation, food, housing, entertainment, and all of the other things that college students, including my daughter, spend money on. And college students, I have learned, have a voracious appetite for spending money. So maybe this type of program would cover 30, 40% of total college expenses. So at the same time, while you're involved with prepaid college tuition, you have to have another engine working for you. And I think that's where you utilize mutual funds. And of course, I'm a believer in indexing, using index stock mutual funds, having a well-diversified portfolio of indexes, I think makes good sense if you're in a position to do that.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's continue. We'll go to someone on the campus, line number two. Hello.
Morning. Mm-hmm. I've got a capital gains question. First time we've received a 1099-B from MetLife because of an extinguishment. They went, like, private or something. And we have a, $1,200 cash that they gave us. And if I just understood you in your intro to say that it, I called them and they said it was the both date acquired and the date sold is the same day. So it's, if it's a short term. And if I was wondering, when I heard you, did you mean that the short-term capital gains is, like, not taxed?
No, that's not true. Short-term capital gains are taxed as if you had ordinary income. So, in other words, were you a participant or were you a policyholder in an insurance policy at MetLife?
Yes, a policy.
All right, and then MetLife notified you that because they were becoming a demutualized company and they were going to become a stock company, that you had a choice of taking stock or cash. Is that what happened?
Right.
All right. And then you opted for cash.
Right.
And that cash then is going to be treated as ordinary income. You're going to pay ordinary income tax on that cash.
Okay.
So whatever marginal bracket you find yourself in, that's what you're going to actually pay tax on that basis. So if you're in a 28% bracket, 28% times $1,200, that will be the tax impact.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. And to Urbana for our next caller. This is line number three.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I had a question on what I do to lower my taxes when I have the house paid off. I'm maxed out on a 403B, my wife on a 401K. We have no deductions. Where do we put our money to lower our taxes?
Well, you've asked the $64 question because most of the tax-lowering strategies are not available to you unless you, one, itemize, two, make serious charitable contributions, which then, of course, goes back to itemizing. But the days of putting your money in any tax shelters, well, those days are over. So if, for example, you felt your major objective was to lower your taxes, then you could take interest and dividend income and reposition those assets into, for example, a very high-grade quality municipal bond portfolio. Do you have a municipal bond portfolio? Well, municipal bonds typically are free from federal income tax. They may be subject to state income tax. That is the interest that is earned on a municipal bond portfolio. May be subject to state income tax, but generally not subject to federal income tax. So what lots of folks do who have substantial assets in 403b programs, 401k programs, or perhaps pension programs, that in addition with additional funds that they have to invest, they might start a municipal bond portfolio. The other alternative is to utilize tax-efficient mutual funds, for example, indexes. And there are any number of indexes, including things as simple as the S&P 500, the Russell 2000, which can be purchased from mutual fund companies in what are called tax-efficient mutual funds. They typically throw off less capital gains, less ordinary income, so that you have less tax impact with those kinds of investments. But as far as finding a good old-fashioned tax shelter, that day is really over. And most of those didn't work very well, to be honest about it, anyway. Well, so you could look at municipal bonds.
With the municipal bonds, a lot of these bond programs, they want $5, $10, $15, $20,000 to start up with. What kind of ballpark figure are we talking about here?
Well, you could go to a mutual fund, and with as little as $3,000, you could get into a municipal bond mutual fund, maybe even $1,500. Now, if I were going to go that route and purchase municipal bonds through a bond fund, I'd want to make certain that my average maturity of my municipal bond fund was no greater than 5 years. Any bond fund, any fixed income fund, it is the rare exception where you want to be in a fund that has an average maturity of the bonds in that fund of greater than 5 years, because there is just too much volatility in the fund. So make certain that the key thing is quality of the fund, the quality of the investments, and two, a relatively short-term life, a short-term average maturity of the bonds in that fund. If you have more money to invest, then I'm always a believer in buying the municipal bonds themselves, because then you eliminate the expenses of the mutual bond fund. But with smaller amounts of money, a mutual bond fund makes sense as long as it has a very short duration, a very short-term average maturity, and it is comprised of high-quality bonds.
All right. Well, thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you for the call. Just about the midpoint here. Again, our guest is David Sinnoh, President and CEO of Strategic Capital Bank and Trust. And monthly, on a Friday, he's here. We do these programs on money management. He does his best to answer your questions. If you have a financial planning question, you can call us, 333-9455, toll-free. 800-222-9455. We have another local person here in Urbana, line one.
Yes. What do you think of Treasury's, the inflation-adjusted securities which they offer for the fixed income portion of a portfolio?
Well, they're okay. Are you doing this inside an IRA or inside a pension plan?
Could be.
Yeah, I mean, if you're doing it inside an IRA or a pension plan, because then, remember, you're not getting hit with any of the income as it is aggregating plan. And that's
right.
That would be the appropriate place to utilize that type of investment. But really, for my money right now, I think that there are certificates of deposits available through banks and banking institutions which pay basically a higher net rate than you would earn in the Treasury market, whether they are indexed or whether they are standard vanilla Treasuries. So there is about a 0.5% premium that banks are paying over the Treasuries right now in order to attract deposits. This is the number one problem for banks in this country, is competing for deposits so they can fund their loan demand and utilize deposits for whatever purposes they need deposits for. So as a result, certificates of deposit right now are paying substantially more than U.S. Treasuries. Again, you're looking at 6 to 12 to 18, maybe as much as 24 months in either Treasuries or CDs if you want to compare apples and apples.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
All right, and thank you. And let's see. Next, we'll go to Crystal Lake, line number 4.
Hi. Charitable giving of these big estates like of Bill Gates or Warren Buffett, et cetera. I understand these trust foundations, according to a multinational monitor, and I think it said that they can use it somewhat like a checking account, maybe not quite as easily, but they can charge their travel expenses and other expenditures that the rich make. That part, I think, is not really charitable. It's really a good way for them to avoid tax, mainly not...
Well, I think in all fairness, though, that if you look at the major predominant foundations in America, whether it's a Rockefeller Foundation, Ford Foundation, or Bill Gates for that matter, what you really found is that they have donated literally hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars directly for charitable purposes. It is true that some of these larger foundations have the ability to employ individuals, pay them a salary, etc. But Internal Revenue Service is pretty tough about this, and they stay on top of these things, and there aren't these egregious activities going on that people are speculating about, at least the ones that I'm familiar with. And in fact, our own organization, Strategic Capital, recently set up its own public foundation. It's called Strategic Capital Foundation. And let me tell you that it's a public charity. People can donate money to the charity and then through what's called a donor-advised fund, advise the charity as to how they want their money distributed. I can tell you firsthand that Internal Revenue Service is right on top of these things. They're very carefully audited and examined. So there is not a lot of room for abuse. And even if a large charity hires people, retains people, pays for travel and meals, it seems to me that some of these charities are just some of the leading charities in the country and have just donated literally hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. Your point is well taken. There can be abuse. But for the most part, I think it's overstated.
All right. Let's go on to Eureka. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have would like a clarification about a guest that was on the Rukeyser program. It was 2 weeks ago, and it was the founder of the Vanguard Funds. Now, I don't know whether you heard him on that program.
I didn't. That's John Bogle, though.
Yeah.
Mr. Bogle.
Yes. And he was talking about what he was recommending was like owning the whole market. And over a long period of time, he was comparing owning the whole market versus, I think it was a mutual fund. And what he was talking about, most of all his comments were about the fees, the hidden fees and things like that on a mutual fund. Now, is there a difference between, like, well, if you want the whole market, would index be the way to go? And what are these ones where it says the fees eat up? Well, he gave an example there. You put in a few thousand dollars, and over 40 years, why, you'd have, oh, maybe $1 million. Whereas if you had it in this other type of fund, which I thought was maybe a mutual, it said the fees ate it up, and you'd wind up with maybe a tenth of that amount. Could you clarify that?
Well, I didn't see the actual program, but let me address some of those issues. Mr. Vogel, of course, as the founder of Vanguard, is naturally going to tout his index funds, and it happens that Vanguard has a fund called the Total Market Index, which mirrors the entire U.S. market. Now, that particular fund doesn't hold every stock that is traded in the U.S., but it holds enough stock so it has about a 99% certainty of doing what the overall stock market does on a daily basis. And because it is such a very large fund, literally with billions of dollars in the fund, Vanguard's approach is to keep the fee structure very, very low. So I believe the fees on that particular mutual fund are somewhere between 0.2% and 0.3%.
Yes.
And Mr. Bogle argues, and fairly persuasively, and that's one of the arguments that I continue to make over the years, that one of the predominating factors in how well you do in your investing is your fee structure. So if you can reduce your fees by annually 1% or 1.5%, it's going to make a big difference, all other things being equal. And in most mutual funds which are actively managed, in other words, you have a manager trying to outperform a specific benchmark area of the market, you're going to have a manager buying, selling, doing all kinds of things, lots of analysts, as well as being paid a very handsome fee if that manager can outperform the market. And indeed, in these kinds of mutual funds, it may well be that the total fee structure, some of which you see disclosed and some of which you don't, may well be at least 2%. It's not unusual. So if you're in a fund that does the same job that the total market index does, and your fees are 2%, and the total market index is 0.2%, it doesn't sound like a lot of difference in any one given year. But if you compound those numbers over 25, 30, or 40 years, it's a gigantic number. It could be hundreds of thousands of dollars. And that's his essential argument. Now, a lot of mutual fund managers will tell you, well, that's just wonderful and that's very self-serving, but we are trying to outperform the benchmark. And Mr. Vogel, all he is doing is saying, look, over long periods of time, it's impossible to outthink the market. So let's just match the market inexpensively as possible. And they are two really very competing philosophies. My philosophy, of course, is much, much closer to Mr. Vogel because of the hundreds of millions of dollars our company manages. Most of it is indexed or sits in what are called asset classes, which are different areas of the market. And by sitting in several different areas of the market, baskets of stocks, that you obtain a level of diversification, which is very important, especially in years like last year, where people who were not properly diversified, well, they got their head sort of handed back to them in a basket. So Mr. Vogel is very persuasive, and I think that one of the services that he performs is the educational material for the beginning investor, which is available on their website, which is www.vanguard.com. I might also say, even though I agree with his philosophy, I don't have any financial interest in Vanguard. In fact, personally, I don't even own a Vanguard mutual fund. So I'm saying this as an unbiased observer.
I have just a little short comment. In terms of the total market, there is the New York. I was wondering, where does the Russell 2000 fit in compared to that total market?
It's quite a different animal. A much different animal.
If you break down
the market, the 500 biggest companies are called the S&P 500.
Right.
The next 500 are called the mid-caps. The next 2,000 are called the Russell 2000. When you are buying the total market index, which consists of all of those, plus a large number of other companies that are traded on the exchanges, what you find out is that the major percentage of each dollar you are investing ends up in the S&P 500,
yes,
in the biggest of the big, because it is a market-weighted average. So most of your dollar is ending up in GE and Intel and Cisco and the biggest of the big. A very, very tiny portion of your dollar is ending up in the Russell 2000. And similarly, when you buy the total market index, most of it are in the big companies. So if I were investing a dollar and I wanted exposure, I'd want maybe 25 cents of my dollar specifically in the index, which is the S&P 500, but I maybe want 30 cents of my dollar specifically in the Russell 2000.
Yes.
Follow the difference?
Yes.
Yes.
You'd have to purchase those separately as
absolutely
indexes, as indexes.
Absolutely. Those were very good questions, and appreciate the opportunity to answer those.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I heard part of the replay on the radio of that very show, and indeed the thing that struck me was his saying that he seemed to be saying, no matter how good a fund manager you are, over the long haul, you're not going to outperform
the market because we're all the market. We are all the market. So if every fund manager out there is trying to outperform the market, some are going to outperform the market. Some have got to underperform the market because the market itself is delta neutral. Mm-hmm. So some are going to do a little better. Some are going to do worse. And I think he argues fairly persuasively that over very long periods of time, we're talking 20 to 30 year periods of time, 9 out of every 10 managers are going to underperform the market. I happen to believe that, so I want to buy baskets of stock in the marketplace itself.
Yeah. Okay. We headed into about our last 15 minutes here. We have a couple of other callers. We'll get right back to it. Bloomington next, line 3. Hello.
Okay. Yeah, I have a couple of comments and then a couple of questions. The first comment, a little different perspective on this idea of paying off a house, whether one is retired or not, strikes me if you pay it off, you have an awful lot of resources tied up in an illiquid asset that also varies in value and in marketability over time. And why not invest that money in some asset that's more liquid so that if you have an emergency come along, you can access that money in an instant?
Well, I'm not disagreeing with that either. I think, remember, that when you talk about a personal residence that is your own personal residence, typically it is not quite as illiquid as perhaps you're suggesting, because you could easily go down to a financial institution and quickly pledge that asset if you needed some collateral.
Perhaps, but I think the person you were talking about is somebody that had a fairly limited cash flow situation in retirement, and it may be difficult for that person to do that.
Well, if they have a limited cash flow situation in retirement, I'd be much more in favor of getting rid of that mortgage to free up those cash flow dollars. That would be me. The other thing you...
Except that everything that's involved in paying off that mortgage is illiquid, and that money can be invested safely and accessible in a minute's notice. If the person has to sell the house or is not in a good position to refinance, he doesn't have very immediate access to those resources.
Okay. Well, again, I think what you're suggesting and what I'm suggesting is that every individual situation is different, so it would need to be analyzed on a case-by-case basis. But your points are well taken. I'm not disagreeing.
Right, because, you know, with a safe investment, while you can end up with your tax break on the interest and then a non-taxable investment, it basically is a wash and you have the money liquid.
Okay.
So that was basically my point on that. The other point I'd like to make, I don't have a vested interest in Vanguard either, but if you look at the comparative fee structures of mutual funds, they are definitely among the lowest in the industry.
Yes, no question about that.
I agree that makes a difference. The other question I have some sheltered money that I won't be forced to remove anything from for about 10 years, and have that strictly invested in high-tech investments right now. And given that I could afford to lose that money if I had to, do you think it's prudent and that we'll have some decent tech cycles in the next 10 years?
Absolutely. I mean, look, over the last 12 months, the tech sector is down, 44-45%, close to two standard deviations.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a very strong probability that when an asset class is down close to two standard deviations from its norm, that within a reasonably short period of time, there's a very substantial recovery. So I would be the last person to recommend selling that sector. And indeed, I have some of my own funds in the tech sector. And like everyone else last year, I was not pleased with those results, but I certainly would hold those positions, especially when you're in the prominent position and the happy position where you don't have to access that money.
Okay, and two other questions with respect to that. How would you lean with respect to perhaps, rather than a couple of mutual funds, plugging all that money in the NASDAQ 100 or else buying Cisco that's at about 30 right now and was as high as over 70 at one point?
Well, I never make recommendations about individual companies, even though Cisco is a great company. And when I invest in the NASDAQ, I'm in the NASDAQ 100. That's where my money is, so that's all I can tell you.
You consider that good diversification?
Well, I consider it, if I'm not intelligent enough to figure out the 4 or 5 or 8 or 10 stocks that are going to admirably perform, so I'd rather own the NASDAQ 100.
Okay, is there any implication for a fee structure with that NASDAQ 100 other than normal commissions of buying a stock?
Not really, and in fact, you could actually buy the QQQs, which really is a trailing stock, so you can control.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, so you can control when you get in and out of that position.
So the return with respect to that is simply market value. There isn't any management or fee structure involved in whoever put that together.
You've got it.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, very good. Let's go to Urbana, line one, for another caller. Hello.
Is it my turn?
Yes.
I was wondering about the Janus funds. They seem to have bombed out this past year, and I was wondering if you could talk about what happened and what their prospects for the future are.
Well, the Janus funds are a very well-known family of mutual funds who've had a tremendous ride over the last 3 to 5 years, with the exception of last year. Specifically, the Janus fund itself, which is a flagship large cap fund, and the Janus 20 fund, Janus Worldwide, Janus High Tech, oh, there's Janus Enterprise, you name them, Janus Mercury. But they all have essentially made the same bet over this 3 to 5 year period of time, and that is that they moved slowly out of the bricks and mortar companies and more into the high tech companies. And that bet paid off big time over the last 3 to 5 years, with the exception of last year, when these positions dropped some 20-25% in value. And in fact, Janus sent out a letter to all of its shareholders explaining how badly they felt and how quickly volatility caught up with them, and it actually surprised them. However, they did say in this letter that this does not change their philosophy. They still look at a company based upon its cash flow, based upon its earnings. They do the same research. And if for those people who have Janus positions, if they have held those positions for the last 3 to 5 years despite the returns of last year, they probably have compounded returns over the last 5 years somewhere between 15 and 20%, certainly double digits. So bottom line is that I certainly would not jettison these positions. I would hang on to these positions. And I think Janus is well managed, has some good philosophies, and certainly got caught in a period of time where the types of stocks they were in are out of favor. But that will change and that will return. And I look for Janus to continue to, over the long period of time, have the kinds of returns that they're capable of returning to the shareholders.
So how long do you think it'll take to make up what we lost?
No idea. I mean, that's in the hands of the markets and the hands of the gods. The bottom line is do not jettison your positions. If those positions lost 20, 25, 30%, that's the worst time to sell. The only time that you lose money is because of behavior. It's the behavior of the investor, not the stocks itself. It's investment behavior. So you have to be willing to deal with the emotion and control investment behavior and hold on to those positions.
In other words, just hang in there.
You bet.
Thank you.
You bet. You're a long-term investor, so that's what you have to do.
All right. Thank
okay,
you.
Thank
Let's
you.
Go to another person in Urbana. This is line number two.
Hi. I actually have two questions. I had an initial question and then something that you commented on stimulated another one. The question that was stimulated by your answer to a previous question was your statement that the last thing you want to do is retire and have a mortgage. Is there anything hidden in what you're saying except for the fact that when you retire, you may be earning less, and so you don't want to have to deal with a mortgage? Is there something else?
No, I think the truth of the matter is that of the 200 or 300 families that our organization represents, and I don't think they're atypical, they may have a little bit more money than a lot of families. The bottom line is that most people don't end up spending less in retirement. That's really what I'm finding out, and I've seen that over the last 5 or 10 years. And this notion that somehow you're going to be in a lower income tax bracket has proved to be basically nonsensical. People basically are in the same marginal tax rate. And what their biggest concern is inflation, and that is running out of money before they run out of life. And a very expensive mortgage with all of the real estate taxes that go along with it and all of the utilities and everything else, it's very expensive to maintain a house, as we all know. And if you have issues about how much money you're going to have in retirement, that seems to me to be one asset that you don't want to have to worry about.
Okay.
You want to lock that in so you don't have to worry about paying that mortgage payment every month. And even though it may only be at a 7% interest rate, remember that mortgage payment consists of not only the interest that you're paying, but the principal that you have to pay as well on the pay down. So if you have a $100,000 mortgage, maybe your interest is only $600 or $700 a month, but to amortize that mortgage, maybe it's an $1,100 or $1,200 a month payment. So in terms of the actual cash flow, that's what I'm really referring to, out of your pocket, it can be very, very difficult to cash flow your retirement if you have a very substantial mortgage.
Okay. Well, okay, that's sort of what I thought. My big question is the following. I run a dog rescue organization. We filed for incorporation, and we have, we've gotten incorporated, and we have just filed for charitable status. I'm wondering about the issue of whether or not eventually we should be thinking in terms of a foundation. I don't understand the concept of a foundation and whether or not that's a useful thing to have.
You know, I don't think, based upon the information that you've given me over the telephone, that I really could react to that.
Okay.
I think you really need to consult with your attorney about that. And where are you calling from?
Urbana.
There are two or three very prominent attorneys in Champaign-Urbana. I'd be happy to have you call our office off the air at 398-3816. I could give you some names of people who specialize in these areas.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to the next caller. This is Aurora, line four. Hello.
Yeah, I think I'm talking to the same situation that this man about, 3 callers back. about the fact that if you invest $10,000 in the S&P 500 over the past 5 years would have yielded you $34,000 versus $25,000 in a stock fund. And so this article in the Reader's Digest, it tells about the Vanguard 500 Index Fund and the Fidelity Magellan Fund. And using that, better to invest in a fund than an average stock fund. So I was wondering what I ought to do with any of my stocks that are in just a regular, an average stock fund. Should I take them out and go into a mutual fund?
Well, that is a complicated question because that has to do with if you sell your stocks or your stock mutual funds, you may be subject to a capital gains tax. So you would have to figure out whether or not it made sense based upon the capital gains tax and how well those funds have done. But the essential point is this, and let me just give you a mathematical example. If you invested $10,000 in Fund A and you earned 8% net after fees and you left it there for 40 years, you'd have about $217,000. If you invested $10,000 in Fund B, and because it had a 1% increase in expenses, you ended up with the same gross rate, but you only ended up with 7%, 1% less over 40 years. Your $10,000 would be worth $150,000 as opposed to $217,000. So the expense issue gets magnified not in the first few years, but over long, long periods of time. So I would caution you again to sell a mutual fund simply because of its expense ratio. I would go back and examine the mutual fund and see how it's done among its peers, and also to make certain that you understand the tax impact or the capital gains tax impact if you sold and repositioned your funds.
Thank you so much.
All right, thank you. We're just about at the point where we're out of time. Any last thought you'd like to leave with folks?
No, I appreciate all the telephone calls and all of the calls this morning. They were great calls and lots of areas to discuss, and it's always fun for me. And David, again, thank you, and thank you for the opportunity to appear on this program.
Okay. Dave Sinnoh, President, CEO, Strategic Capital Bank and Trust. He's here on the program once a month. It's almost on a Friday. He'll be back next month. We'll do it again. In the meantime, you can get a wrap-up of the week's activity on Wall Street by tuning to our TV station, WILL-TV, for Wall Street Week with Louis Rukeyser Friday night at 7:30. And then for personal finance advice and information, tune to the program Sound Money Saturday mornings at 10 right here on AM 580. And they do have parts of the program where you may call in and ask questions of the various financial experts they have on the show.